You are listening to Books Are My People, a podcast for book lovers with book news, recommendations, and ruminations on living a literary life in Los Angeles. This is episode 98, and I am recording on Wednesday, March 8th, 2023. So we've officially passed the four-week mark since my dog ran away from her walker when we were out of town. Things haven't gotten any easier. We're still working our butts off trying to get her back and locate her. I'm so grateful to all of our friends and family that have helped us hang posters and hand out flyers and post online and call with new and creative ideas, and also to people who have told us inspirational stories of their own that involve reuniting with a missing pet. We really want that happy ending. Since I work from home, I really feel her absence the most when I'm at home, so I've been staying really, really unusually busy and out of the house lately. I've been to the theater twice, going out to dinner a lot, explored Manhattan Beach a couple times in a week, and went out to two book events, and tonight I'm heading out to trivia night. So there's always someone at home waiting in case our pup makes her way back. But on to some happier things. My youngest son turned 14, which means really my two boys are both like a whisper away from being full-on adults. It's so surreal. He had a great birthday weekend with a movie night and a little sleepover and lots of pull-ups. He's really into pull-ups. I don't think I can pull off one pull-up. And since we have a break from hockey, he's decided to start playing lacrosse on a spring league in his free time, and I am exhausted just thinking about it. And I'm getting ready to open up my Books Are My People Etsy store. I've been making these adorable, if I do say so myself, little journals from upcycled papers and books, so I'm excited about sharing them with the world. My friend in San Francisco is selling them at her store, and her store is called Simple, if anyone living in San Francisco wants to visit and purchase a book. So many of you have joined my new Books Are My People newsletter, and I've enjoyed curating even more books to send you weekly. Feel free to invite all of your bookish friends to sign up. I'll leave a link in the show notes, or you can find it on my bio on Instagram. I'll be doing my second ever Instagram Live tomorrow, Tuesday, March 14th at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time with Annie Sullivan from So This. Annie has been a former guest on the show, and she runs a wonderful online book club. The last time we went live, there was some live laggage. I can't say why, but I have my fingers crossed that things will go smoothly this time. And we'll be taking reading recommendation requests from all of you. So if you're looking for a book in a specific genre to read, maybe you want a book to read on an upcoming vacation, maybe you just finished a book you loved and want something like it, send me an email at booksaremypeople@gmail.com and write book recommendation in the subject, and we will prep some book suggestions for you on our live. Do this today so we have time to sift through them before tomorrow. The incredibly smart and talented Rebecca Mackay is my guest today. I loved her latest novel. I have some questions for you. And actually, I've loved all of her novels, but I'm going to make you wait for it because first, it's time for some bookish news. According to Quartz, women are now publishing more books than men. In the 1960s, women made up 18% of the books published, and in 2020, that dial moved to around 50% of books being published by women. And now that number has risen even more, so go us. I'll leave a link to the full article in the show notes. And again, I'm in a total lost dog fog, so bear with me getting through this. I'm really trying my best, but I find like even reading notes or reading a book is very challenging. Right now I am having a lot of trouble concentrating. Okay. And so you think I'm fair and balanced? Let's talk about Ray Bradbury. According to the Daily Herald, his personal collection of books and artifacts will be preserved and showcased at what was his childhood library in his hometown of Waukegan. After his death in 2012, half of these items were donated, while the other half was acquired from storage. These items were formerly at the Carnegie Library. He lived in Waukegan until 1934, when his family moved out to Los Angeles. And according to the LA Times, and because I live in LA, I feel like it's my duty to report that the finalists for the LA Times Book Prize have been announced and include my favorite George Saunders for his short fiction collection, Liberation Day. And that was in the Ray Bradbury Prize for Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Speculative Fiction. And a couple other standouts for me were Ping Shepherd's The Cartographers in the Mystery and Thriller section. That book was great, and I don't think I've talked about it on the show yet. And Rachel Housel Hall for We Lie Here, also in the Mystery and Thriller section. For a complete list of nominees in every category, check out the link in the show notes. Before we get to our guest author recommendation, I wanted to plug two extra books. The first is Black Candle Woman by Diane Marie Brown, which came out last week. It's a warm and wry family drama with a magical twist about four generations of Black women, a family curse, and one very complicated year of heartache, miscommunication, and learning to let go. And again, that's Black Candle Woman by Diane Marie Brown. And the second is A Likely Story by Lee Abramson, which comes out tomorrow. The only child of an iconic American novelist discovers a shocking tangle of family secrets that upends everything she thought she knew about her parents, her gilded childhood, and her own stalled writing career. And again, that's A Likely Story by Lee Abramson. And now it's time for a guest author recommendation. Today, it's from Therese Svoboda. She is the author of 19 books of poetry, fiction, biography, memoir, and translation. She's won a Guggenheim, a Pushcart Prize, an O. Henry Award, and her opera, Wet, premiered at LA's Disney Hall. Dog on Fire is her latest book, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. Everyone likes ghost stories, except Dog on Fire isn't exactly that. Imagine a sad, funny elegy. Cather channeling Saunders with infusions of sly wit. Imagine a sibling who is so inscrutable he seems to be from another family entirely, who dies before you get to know him. Of course, the family in Dog on Fire is dysfunctional. An alcoholic mother who carves wax guns, a father whose passion is smoking anything vaguely edible, a sister who hears her dead brother in door molding, a dreadful dust storm gets the book off to a good start with the glimpse of the shovel-wielding ghost. What Dog on Fire does best is haunt, and its succinct, almost poetry, seeks to enchant you. So let's hear from Therese about her recommendation.
Hi, I'm Therese Svoboda, and my novel, Dog on Fire, my eighth book of fiction, was released March 7th. I'm reviewing Pity the Beast, Robin McLean's first novel. She's Faulkner Wilde. No, she's more Faulkner meets Cormac McCarthy meets Joy Williams. What a party. Set in Montana, a lot of horses are involved, bestial humans, and a biblical sense of justice. Pity the Beast is not an easy read. We are the most animal of animals, she writes. Although the publisher is British, she's going after the most primal and violent sector of American experience. The language in Pity the Beast is fierce, unforgiving, and haunting, excavating the most feral edges of the human condition.
Thank you, Therese. And again, her latest book is Dog on Fire, out now. I will leave a link in the show notes, and her recommendation was Pity the Beast by Robin McLean. Rebecca Mackay's last novel, The Great Believers, was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. It was the winner of the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction, the Stonewall Book Award, the Clark Prize, and the LA Times Book Prize, and it was one of the New York Times' 10 best books of 2018. Her other books are the novels The Borrower and The 100-Year-Old House, and the collection Music for Wartime, four stories from which appeared in the Best American Short Stories. A 2022 Guggenheim Fellow, Rebecca is on the MFA faculties of the University of Nevada, Reno at Lake Tahoe and Northwestern University, and is Artistic Director of Story Studio Chicago. So hello, Rebecca.
Hello.
I am sitting here having recently finished your wonderful and meaty novel. I have some questions for you. It's a book that everyone is talking about, and all I want to do is read it all over again. It was such a fantastic reading experience.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Where are you calling in from today?
I am in Seattle. I have a reading here tonight, and then I'm sticking around the weekend actually for a big writer's conference. So I actually get to unpack my suitcase because I'm here for like four nights.
It's EWP this weekend, right?
That's it.
They're offering so many events online this year, which is fantastic for people who aren't able to travel to be there.
That is wonderful. It's something, you know, one of those silver linings of the pandemic, right? That they realized that, you know, because there are so many reasons that someone might not be able to actually travel. So it's, you know, we've realized that my own organization, Story Studio Chicago, we could not sell an online class to save our lives before the pandemic. We do writing classes, and now that's half of what we do.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, in your own words, can you tell us what your novel, I Have Some Questions For You, is about?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a narrator named Bodie Kane. She's 40 years old. It's 2018. And she's invited back for 2 weeks in the dead of winter to the campus of the New Hampshire boarding school that she herself had attended. She's a film historian, so she's going back to teach one class on film history, but another class on podcasting because she also has a film history podcast. And while she's back on campus, her mind is, of course, back on the mid-1990s when she graduated from the school, but very specifically on the death of a young woman named Thalia Keith. Thalia died at the end of their senior year. She wasn't friends with Bodie, but they had roomed together the year before. And Thalia was found in the campus swimming pool, but with significant injuries to her body. And a young Black man named Omar Evans, who worked as an athletic trainer at the school, was pretty immediately arrested. There was a mountain of evidence against him, and so Bodie never particularly questioned it, and has known for a while that there are a lot of people online who believe that Omar is innocent. And while she has questions about what happened, that mountain of evidence, she's always assumed it's correct. But when she's back on campus, one of her podcasting students wants to do her podcast looking back on the death of Thalia Keith. And this young woman believes that Omar Evans is innocent. And I'm not giving too much away here. Before long, Bodie comes to be of the same opinion. And we go from there.
I loved the early on shout out to UCLA, where I teach creative writing. And there's a general feeling of nostalgia to the novel. Bodie's revisiting her past, which, as you said, is colliding with her present. And she's also sort of examining how the space at Granby has changed. And I just found your descriptions to be so cinematic. The novel from the get-go is addressed to the person that Bodie actually thinks committed the crime. Can you talk about how you came up with this compelling structural choice?
You know, I wish I remembered. I can talk about what it does for the book. But the thing is, I started the book at the Ragdale Foundation, artist residency near Chicago, my favorite artist residency, by the way. Everyone should apply. And I was there for 3 weeks. I was, you know, just throwing all the spaghetti at all the walls, trying to figure out what this book was. And in that time, you try everything. And nothing you try seems particularly momentous because you don't know. But at some point in those 3 weeks, I tried this direct address angle on the book. And what I can say is I know why it worked for me. On the one hand, it makes a lot of your decisions for you in terms of that what I call the ear of the story, who's ostensibly listening to this narrative, how much do they know? What do they need to be filled in on? How casual is the tone? How intimate is the tone? All those decisions were made once I knew who she was thinking this at. Then also, you know, it's a chance to kind of direct her anger at a certain person, which was helpful. There's also, of course, the sense that the reader, for the most part, I think the reader is going to put themselves in Bodie's shoes. But the reader can't help. I can't help when I'm reading something that says you. I can't help but feel implicated a little bit. And this is a book that asks us about our own involvement in true crime, our own voyeurism, the sort of true crime industrial complex, even as I'm writing about, of course, a fictional crime. And so I did like what that might do to a reader to kind of cast, you know, their questions back upon themselves. And then that you is there, the you is the first word of the book. You is there in the title as well.
How much did you have to do in terms of research? I was curious if you listened to any true crime podcasts, and if so, if you have any that you'd recommend. I loved Serial. I was curious if you've listened to that. And also, I just wanted to throw in that the names of the podcasts that Bodhi students are working on are all so fantastic. I would listen to any one of them.
Aw, thanks. I had fun writing those students, those 2018 students. I do and have listened to true crime podcasts. And of course, I grew up on Dateline and Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted. Our fascination with true crime is nothing new. I, like a lot of people, am simultaneously completely drawn into certain things. Like right now, it's the Murdoch murders in South Carolina. Like, give me all the information all the time. And then really queasy about why we're doing that and what that does to the case and the suspects. It's so complicated because good has come out of that. The Murdoch murders, you know, some of the things that have that convicted that guy were things that podcasters and other journalists uncovered that the lawyers would have otherwise missed. There's also good that comes out of some of these in terms of highlighting cases that would not have been maybe very telegenic, or highlighting cases that would not have gotten high ratings on Dateline, whether that's just, you know, an older victim or it just, you know, a something where it's not a young, wealthy person. Certainly people of victims when it's a person of color as a victim, podcasting, responsible podcasting can highlight those in a way that television still seems to refuse to do. And that news coverage seems to refuse to do. There's also on the upside, you know, we've like identified Jane Doe's online from certain podcasts or gotten people to submit familial DNA. Those are great. On the flip side, re-victimizing families, bungling investigations. This woman in England who went missing recently and people just tromped all over the crime scene or the scene of her disappearance, rather. You get suspects who are being stalked. You get lives ruined from this thing. There's a fetishization of young dead women that is not helping anyone with anything. So I'm, you know, that's those that all those conflicted feelings are, you know, a good reason to write a novel about it, basically. And this novel is not coming down on the side of they're good or they're bad. It's like, yeah, this is a big mucky tar pit. Let's get stuck in it together. The ones that I really appreciate, I really like Undisclosed, which does a lot of innocence project work and has done really made progress in certain cases. Started as a follow-up to Serial with the Adnan Syed case. If anyone was interested in that case and has not listened to the first season of Undisclosed, that you have to do that right away. I'm really interested in the work that Paul Holes is doing, the Cold Case Investigator. His first podcast, unfortunately, the co-host turned out to be skeezy, so it got canceled. But he's doing a new one where they're looking back at historical crimes, and he's trying to, that was called, it's either called Buried Bones or Unburied Bones. I think it's Unburied Bones, where he's trying to, you know, shed light on old cases. So I love things like that, you know, but I'm a sucker for any of it. And that is, you know, interesting and somewhat problematic.
In this novel, you explore issues around the amplification of trauma and how it grows legs on the internet. There's this notion that everyone wants to be close to the victim or have a connection to them for their own reasons. And you have a great line about how victims become, and I'm quoting here, public property subject to the collective imagination. Can you talk about the concept of memory and its importance and significance in the novel?
Yeah. You know, I made the decision early on that we weren't going to jump back narratively to 1995. We certainly could have. I was The Great Believers, my previous book, was jumping back and forth between the 1980s and 2015. I had just done it. It's like you just did a 20-mile bike ride. The last thing you want to do is ride your bike anymore. So I didn't want to do that. And I have a pet peeve when I'm reading, and it is just a pet peeve. I know other people are fine with it. I'm not into the thing of, you know, someone is looking out a window and suddenly they have a capital M memory. And then we get 12 pages of completely chronological, accurate, detailed memory of something that happened 30 years earlier. Like, we're there. And I do think it's a convention that writers have borrowed from film, actually, because the camera, you kind of have to jump back. You can't have little tiny pieces. You've got to just go, here's the scene. Fiction didn't used to do that before film did that. And it is absolutely not the way that memory works. So I'm facing this impossibility, which is, well, how do I get across all of this backstory without the lie of detailed memory and without jumping back there? And the answer for me was to make it a book about memory thematically, about the fallibility, the subjectivity of memory, about the groupthink that goes on, the way that we, you know, in comparing our stories in the moment might lose something, but in comparing our stories 25 years down the road might gain something. And that was then, you know, the thing that I needed to work with. But it worked, instead of trying to avoid it and instead of trying to solve it, it worked best for me to write about it.
And I think a lot of what Bodhi is going through is she's back in this space where she did have this previous existence, and she's reflecting and trying to make meaning of what she does remember. And she's also seeing it through a different lens. And I just kept thinking of things that happened in my high school, like young women sitting on teachers' laps, which we all thought was totally fine. And looking back on that, I'm like, oh God, that is not okay, and that is not appropriate. So it made me think of all that.
There is that, like, just looking back on, you know, with a modern lens, looking back on your own adolescence, whenever that was, it can be shocking, the kinds of things we put up with and the kind of things we participated in as well.
What are you working on next?
Ooh, okay. So I'm being cryptic, but I'm saying certain things. So none of my books have anything to do with each other. And I love that. I have ADHD. I would get very, very bored writing the same kind of book again. So the new novel, the novel that I believe is next, it may be an easy one, will sneak in there and come first, but set in 1930s Germany, it is not a World War II novel exactly. It's not a Holocaust novel. But it is a novel about complicity, which is something that I think it's really important to think about right now in America. And I was so fortunate to receive a Guggenheim Fellowship this last year, and I used that to travel to Germany last fall for the first time ever, actually, to do some research. And I also tried doing like Duolingo German. I gave up after a few weeks. It was very unpleasant. So not going to do that, but I'm still going to do all the research.
Well, thank you for answering all of my questions about I Have Some Questions for You. And now it's time to move on to the books. So Rebecca, what is your first pick for today?
Okay, so really quick background. I'm doing this project, and I'm writing about it a lot online, called Around the World in 84 Books. And it's a memorial to my late father, who was a literary translator. But I am circling the world, amazing race style, reading 84 books in translation. He lived to be 84. So I'm going to recommend two of those, and then another, and then a boarding school book, because my novel is a boarding school novel. So the first of the translated books is The Door by Magda Szabo. It's a Hungarian novel about a woman's really intense relationship with her housekeeper. And there's a great dog character, the best dog character I've ever read. And it's riveting and absolutely stunning. The Door by Magda Szabo, S-Z-A-B-O.
My first pick is Letters to a Writer of Color, edited by Deepa Annapara and Tamor Somro. And this is a fantastic collection of essays about writing, but you definitely don't need to be a writer to appreciate this collection, each writer focuses on a specific aspect of writing. For example, Amitabha Kumar's essay is on why authenticity isn't a license we carry in our wallets. Chiesa Lehmann, whom I've recommended numerous times on this podcast, focuses his essay on hearing that no one wants to read the story that you want to write. Each essay merits a larger discussion as well as offers insights into each particular writer's style and voice, and it's a great way to get to know a swath of writers so that you can then seek out their books. These pieces also work together to challenge what we lit majors have been taught should be included in the canon, with a capital C, of literature. With writers of color vastly underrepresented in publishing, there's an urgency to these essays, but also a celebration of all they have to offer. And again, that's Letters to a Writer of Color, edited by Deepa Annapara and Tamor Somro. Thank you to NetGalley and to Random House for the advanced review copy. Rebecca, what is your second pick?
Okay, so then the last, the book that I just finished is from Turkey. The author is Sabahattin Ali, and the novel is Madonna in a Fur Coat. It is a literary love story written in the 1940s about a young Turkish man who goes to Berlin, falls in love, kind of a doomed love affair. So the author was then murdered by the government in the late 1940s. This book was not read much at all in the 1940s. And in the past 5 years, it has become the best-selling novel in Turkey. Everyone's really into it. And I think partly because he really plays with gender roles. And of course, this author himself was kind of, you know, at odds with the government. And young readers really don't like the incredibly oppressive presidential regime and the very strict gender roles that guy's trying to enforce. So I think this novel is a way of expressing that and relating to it. So Madonna in a Fur Coat, Sabahattin Ali.
My last pick I mentioned in my newsletter, but I wanted to talk more about it. And it's a total departure from my first pick. And it's called The Golden Spoon by Jessa Maxwell. And this came out March 7th. So if you cross the Great British Bake Off with an Agatha Christie novel, you'd get The Golden Spoon. Betsy Martin is sort of the Prue character. We used to have two hamsters named Paul and Prue, but I digress. Betsy is America's grandmother, and up until recently, she was the sole host of Bake Week, a reality TV show. But this season, producers have added Archie Morris, a charismatic co-host, and Betsy is not happy about it. Six bakers descend on Grafton Manor in Vermont, which is also Betsy's childhood home, for a week-long competition. There's a former journalist, a math teacher, a CEO, a retired nurse, and a couple of other contestants. As the book progresses, we learn about all of their different reasons for wanting to be on the show, and once the competition begins, things are going well for none of them. In fact, it seems as though someone is out to sabotage the bakers. But why? And just how far will things escalate? This is a suspenseful thriller, so I'll leave it at that, but it's definitely on the lighter side of scary. It's a quick read, and I recommend cozying up with a cup of tea and your favorite baked good. And again, that is The Golden Spoon by Jessa Maxwell. And thank you to Simon & Schuster for the advanced review copy. Rebecca, what is your final pick?
And then the third pick, I get asked a lot about other boarding school novels, and I happen to have a favorite that not enough people have read. It's called The Virgins, and it's by the author Pamela Ahrens, E-R-E-N-S. It's put out by Tin House Books, so small press, one of those beautiful soft covers. And it is about not a murder, but a death and a doomed love affair at a thinly disguised Exeter in the 1970s. And it is just a beautiful hothouse of a novel. It's absolutely lovely. The Virgins by Pamela Ahrens.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on the show. Where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, my handle everywhere, basically, is Rebecca Makkai, M-A-K-K-A-I. It's nice to have an unusual name. I can just go with that. But that's my handle on Twitter, on Instagram. And then I have a Substack that is called Submack, S-U-B-M-A-K-K. And that is where I'm writing in detail about the books in translation I read, but I also do weird Zillow listings I find and all kinds of just thoughts on craft and books and silliness and whatever's on my mind.
And what are you going to be reading next?
So the next novel in my trek around the world is from Syria. It is called No Knives in the Kitchens of This City, and it is by Khaled Khalifa.
I'm picking up Danya Kukovka's Notes on an Execution, which I feel like everyone in the world has read, except for me. I was at Zibby's bookstore last night listening to an author friend speak about her novel and noticed that you will be there in April. So I look forward to meeting you in person there.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. And again, please run out and buy I Have Some Questions for You by Rebecca Mackay. You will not be disappointed, and everyone's talking about it, so you'll be able to enter the conversation. As always, I am most active on Instagram at Jennifer Calogaris, or you can search for me by looking for Books Are My People. I will link up to all the books we talked about today, especially Rebecca Mackay's I Have Some Questions for You, in my bookshop.org shop and in the show notes of this episode. And if you want more book titles to add to your TBR list, sign up for my weekly newsletter through the show notes. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and until then, I hope you all have a wonderfully bookish week.